Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Can you hear me okay? Great. we're reading Genesis chapter 34 today. It's not going to be an easy introduction or a light-hearted anecdote to start this one. There's nervous laughter going around, and not least from myself, because depending on what translation you have of this Bible, there's some really, really tough language used in the introduction to this chapter, and there's some really, really difficult themes. And the title that I gave it when I was writing this talk was Dealing with Trauma in the Midst of Blessing. Last week, Karen was speaking about this journey that Jacob was on and his family in seeking the blessing of God in their lives, in seeing that blessing coming in to reality in the midst of where they were, that Jacob had left his home with nothing, that he'd spent a night sleeping with a rock for a pillow, with nothing but the clothes on his back, and that he's on this return journey now to the place that he had left in his younger life with flocks and herds, with a family and children, so much blessing that God has poured out upon him. And in the midst of that, we get this story. There's one chapter here, and in the midst of it, it seems very jarring in the narrative of the story. And it's a story of what happens to his daughter and what happens as a result of these circumstances. So I'm going to read this and hopefully share what God has put on my heart about it. There's some really, really difficult issues involved in this. And I think we can all agree that life is full of difficult circumstances. And that some people will find reading passages like this really, really hard and really difficult. Some of us will read about the trauma that this family experiences and think about the trauma that we've been through in our life. Difficulties, hardship, pain, loss. These are all realities of life that we all have to deal with. And how we deal with them is the Christian experience. This is what it means to follow Jesus. It means to stand in the midst of real life, looking at real events happening around us, and figuring out, how is this part of God's plan? How is God bringing blessing right now? And where is God bringing blessing right now? So we're going to read this together. I'm going to stop a few times as I read through it, but we're reading through Genesis chapter 34. And in fact, I'm going to actually go back to Genesis 33, because there's a couple of verses that give us a little bit of the context. After Jacob had met up with Esau, the last few verses say this: for 100 pieces of silver Jacob bought from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, the land of ground where he pitched his tent. And there he set up an altar and called it El Elohe Israel. So this is the first time that he's actually purchased land in the place where God has sent him. And that right now, this is the end of his journey as a traveler. He's actually bought the piece of land that he's pitched his tent on at this point in the story. And then this next chapter is about a relationship between him and the surrounding nations, and how they're going to deal with each other, how these people are going to form a community. Remember that those blessings that were given to Abraham and then to Isaac, and now that Jacob has taken on, God promised him all nations of the world would be blessed through you and through your offspring. And then this story comes along. Okay, now beginning of chapter 34. Now Dinah, the daughter Leah had born to Jacob, went out to visit the women of that land. And when Shechem, son of Hamor the Hivite, the ruler of that area, saw her, he took her and raped her. His heart was drawn to Dinah's daughter of Jacob. He loved the young woman and spoke tenderly to her. And Shechem said to his father Hamor, "Get me this girl as my wife." When Jacob heard that his daughter Dinah had been defiled, his sons were in the fields with their livestock, so he did nothing about it until they came home. It's a really tricky start to a chapter to look at that and to say, what do we do with this? When we read this, how do we understand a God who wants to bless his people, who wants to bless the offspring of Jacob? And then we read this story. And it follows on from what we just read at the end. He's bought this land. He's pitched his tent. He's wanting to settle and bring blessing to the nations around him. And it starts by saying the very first verse mentions that Dinah goes out to visit the women of this land. And this is when this horrible thing happens. It can't be understated, can it, just how awful this kind of event is. Rape is a real tragedy in so many ways, and it can't be understated enough that what was done to Dinah is awful. And she actually takes a really back seat in the rest of this chapter. We don't hear much from her point of view, but it cannot be understated what a tragedy it is when women are abused, when women are taken advantage of, when women are used by men. And it's so terrible to see in the midst of this chapter a really backwards approach to how things should be. And this comes out a bit later in the chapter. But you see right here in verses 2, 3, and 4, this is how Shechem, this man, responds in this situation. Yet again, we see a pattern that we've seen since the very beginning of the stories of Genesis. Chapter 3 of Genesis, in the fall, it says that Eve and Adam see something that they desire, and they take it for themselves. And then right here, it says in verse 2, Shechem, son of Hamor, he saw her, and he took her, and he raped her. That this is exactly what happens when human beings live for themselves. This is the human condition in itself, that when we see what we desire and we take it for ourselves, we bring destruction and we bring pain and suffering. That we break God's good world. And the trauma and the devastation and the impact it has on those that we mistreat is huge. It's undefinable, isn't it? That it's just one verse that you read here, but any of us who know people who've been through these kind of issues, people who've been through this themselves, know one event and one terrible tragedy can affect your entire lifetime. It doesn't go away. It's deep wounds that can impact generations, not just one person, not just a family, but whole communities can be affected by these terrible tragedies. And it's really hard for us to have a look at that. It's really hard for me as a man to read this and say, I know so much of what is going on here. I can't relate to that kind of trauma. I've got no experiences of that myself. I've been so privileged in my life. And yet, what we're called to do is to see and to understand the trauma that that has, not just on that young lady's life, but on her whole family, that this impacts them deeply. As we read on, we see the impact that it has. And yet, the first thing that we're told that her father does in verse 5, when Jacob heard that his daughter Dinah had been defiled and his sons were with their livestock, he did nothing about it. Reading on in verse 6, then Shechem's father, Hamor, went out to talk with Jacob. And meanwhile, Jacob's sons had come in from the field. As soon as they heard what had happened, they were shocked and furious because Shechem had done an outrageous thing in Israel by sleeping with Jacob's daughter. A thing that should not be done. Isn't it terrible that you have to put that verse in to make that point? This is not the way that things should work. And yet, as we see the story goes on, this is a story about vastly differing worldviews trying to mesh together. That the approach that Shechem takes is first, he takes this woman and he rapes her, and then he falls in love with her, and then he seeks to marry her. And that this narrative, as you see, is he and his father enter into conversation with Jacob and with Jacob's sons. They say, this is the way things work around here. And maybe we can seek each other's benefit here. Maybe we can be a blessing to one another. This becomes the narrative of this story. And yet, isn't it terrible that this is what they have to point out? This is not the way that things should be. And yet, this is a reality of our world. And wouldn't it be great for us to think, things aren't like this anymore? But I think we all know, you know, the broken world views that see things in the opposite way to the way God sees them, where love is a low priority, where peace and thinking of others and seeking the benefit of others first and above ourselves is not the way the world sees things. Isn't that a tragedy that we have to point that out and remind ourselves of that? But what are we going to do about it? In this story, they respond in a really peculiar way, you might say. So here's what happens in the rest of the story. Verse 8 says, His sons had come. I'm reading from verse 7. Meanwhile, Jacob's sons had come in from the fields as soon as they had heard what had happened. They were shocked and furious because Shechem had done an outrageous thing in Israel by sleeping with Jacob's daughter, a thing that should not be done. But Hamor said to them, "My son Shechem has his heart set on your daughter. Please give her to him as his wife. Intermarry with us. Give us your daughters and take our daughters for yourselves. You can settle among us. The land is open to you. Live in it, trade in it, and acquire property in it." Then Shechem said to Dinah's father and brothers, "Let me find favor in your eyes. I'll give you whatever you ask. Make the price for the bride and the gift I am to bring as great as you like, and I'll pay whatever you ask me. Only give me the young woman as my wife." They're making an offer to Jacob and to his sons that this can be prosperous and beneficial for us. Isn't it terrible that circumstances that seem so traumatic at the beginning, the people who perpetrate it are the ones who are saying, maybe this can work out for everyone's benefit. And here's how the sons of Jacob respond, verse 13. "Because the sister Dinah had been defiled, Jacob's sons replied deceitfully as they spoke to Shechem and his father Hamor. They said to them, 'We can't do such a thing. We can't give our sister to a man who is not circumcised. That would be a disgrace to us. We will enter into an agreement with you on one condition only, that you will become like us by circumcising all your males. Then we will give you our daughters and take your daughters for ourselves. We'll settle among you and become one people with you. But if you will not agree to be circumcised, we'll take our sister and go.'" So they respond deceitfully, offering that same offering to accept the offer that they made. And it's interesting, they say right there that the sons of Jacob, as they're lying to these people to their face, say, "We could become one people." That this is the thing that they're seeking, that the people of Shechem and Hamor and his sons, what they're wanting is prosperity for themselves and for their own family. And they see when a huge group of people like Jacob and his sons arrive on their doorstep, they say, if we bring them into our culture, if we incorporate them into our lifestyle, if we become one people with them, we're bigger and we're stronger and we're better for it. Surely that is good. And they make that happen through raping and abusing a girl. And that this is the offer that they make, and this is their desire. They want these two groups of people to become one group of people, but what they really want is Jacob and his sons to adopt their worldview, to see things from their point of view. And they say, that's blessing. We'll be bigger, we'll be stronger, we'll be richer, we'll be better off for it. That's the worldview that they sell. And that kind of deceit can be really pervasive in our culture, can't it? Saying that if we compromise, if we give in, if we do nothing, like what Jacob did in the beginning of that verse, if we do nothing and we just go along with what the world says, is that going to be better for us? Is that how we're going to become rich and prosperous? Is that how we're going to become influential and make a difference in this world? Isn't that what we want to do? Surely if we listen to what the world says and we go by the world's agenda, then that's something we can achieve. So while Jacob did nothing, Jacob's sons, meanwhile, are very busy. We're carrying on from verse 18. Their proposal seemed good to Hamor and his son Shechem. The young man who was the most honored of all his father's family lost no time in doing what they said because he was delighted with Jacob's daughter. So Hamor and his son Shechem went to the gate of their city to speak to the men of their city. So now this one family who's a leader in their community has agreed to do this thing, to go along with this lie that the sons of Jacob have promised. And as a result, now they have to convince all the other men in their community that this is what's best for them. And this is how they pitch it. This is how they sell their idea. Verse 21, this is what they say. They say, "These men are friendly towards us," they said. "Let them live in our land and trade in it. The land has plenty of room for them. We can marry their daughters and they can marry ours. But the men will agree to live with us as one people only on the condition that our males be circumcised as they themselves are. Won't their livestock, their property, and all their animals become ours? So let us agree to their terms and they will settle among us." They believe if they do this bold, crazy gesture, all the males in their midst becoming circumcised, they're like, this is a clear indication that we're committed to them becoming part of us, and this is going to be for our benefit. This is how he sells it to those other men of their community, the other families. This is going to be beneficial for us. So verse 24, all the men who went out of the city gate agreed with Hamor and his son Shechem, and every male in the city was circumcised. 3 days later, while all of them were still in pain, two of Jacob's sons, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, took their swords and attacked the unsuspecting city, killing every male. They put Hamor and his son Shechem to the sword and took Dinah from Shechem's house and left. The sons of Jacob came upon the dead bodies and looted the city where their sister had been defiled. They seized their flocks and herds and donkeys and everything else of theirs in the city out in the fields. They carried off all their wealth and all their women and children, taking as plunder everything in the houses. It's hard to see how the purposes of God work out in the midst of this. When I said, how do we see blessing coming in the midst of trauma? When, in response to that trauma, Jacob appears to do nothing. Jacob's brothers lie and then attack and murder people and then steal from them. And are becoming, and that very thing that those nations, the men of Shechem and Hamor, what they wanted was to become richer and more prosperous through this. And as a result of this crazy action of Simeon and Levi, when they attack and murder people, they become richer. They take all their goods. That actually the nation of Jacob's household becomes blessed, physically blessed, through this process. They become richer. They become, they get all the benefit of all this material goods through this. And then you get this conclusion, verses 30 and 31. The two viewpoints within this family are saying that this passage is a lot about worldviews. There's a worldview difference between God's people, Jacob's family, and the men of Shechem and their worldview. But there's a difference in worldview within the family too. Jacob, it says, doesn't do anything at the beginning. When his daughter is abused and taken advantage of, he doesn't do anything at this point. And so his sons feel like they have to do something. And what they do is they lie, they deceive, they take advantage of people, they kill, they steal. And then, verses 30 and 31, Jacob speaks to his sons. And this is what he says. Then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, "You have brought trouble on me by making me obnoxious to the Canaanites and Perizzites, the people living in this land. We are few in number. And if they join forces against me and attack me, I and my household will be destroyed." But they replied, "Should he have treated our sister like a prostitute?" That's the end of the chapter. We hear no more about this story. The story moves on to other things. And isn't it, as we said at the beginning, trauma of this level and this magnitude has huge consequences. This story may end here, and it doesn't go away. In real life, we know that they would have been dealing with this for the rest of their life. And the consequences of this come up right at the end of Genesis. We'll see it come back. Jacob is going to bring this up to Simeon and Levi again, like 15 chapters later or something. That the consequences are huge and have moved on. And yet, there is a real struggle within the family of Jacob, within the family of God's chosen people. How is God bringing blessing in the midst of? And what are we supposed to do about it? Are we supposed to do nothing? Or are we supposed to take matters into our own hands? Surely, we've got to take matters into our own hands. That's exactly why Simeon and Levi did what they did. They said what was true. They said what has been done to our sister is wrong. And it can't be ignored. And yet what they chose to do, Jacob is also right. He said, "You have brought trouble on me." We see in the beginning of verse 35, just skipping ahead and stealing from whoever's speaking next week a little bit, that the consequences do carry on. They talk about the fact that the fear of God falls upon the surrounding nations so that no one tries to pursue them. And if you miss chapter 34, you'd say, why would the surrounding nations be wanting to pursue them? For this reason. They just murdered and wiped out an entire clan. And this is the land that they're wanting to live in harmony with the surrounding people of. There are consequences to this, and they carry on. And so Jacob is right when he says that they have brought, through their actions, through their lies and deceit, through their murderous ways, they have brought trouble onto this family. They have made things worse. And yet their response is also right. They say, should we have let him treat our sister like a prostitute? Of course not. So what do we do? What's Jacob to do? What's his family to do? I don't have any answers. And the story doesn't give us any answers, does it? The story stops and moves on. But what we do have is the reality of a God who partners with people, who journeys with people, and who is always seeking to bring blessing in the midst of trauma. And we can't see it. We can't see how in those circumstances, can we? And some of the things I want to encourage us to do is to remember who Jacob is and what his name means. Just two chapters before, Jacob had had this really weird encounter with God when he had been renamed Israel, meaning wrestles with God. It comes in the story of literal wrestling. He literally wrestles a man, and yet there's always deep meaning to names in the Bible. And then when God says, you're someone who's wrestled with God, what he means is in these kind of circumstances, when trauma comes and you say, how is this God bringing blessing on me? Do you give up and do nothing? Or do you give in and fight? See, this is the real challenge as well, isn't it? That the sons of Jacob see their sister abused, and they say, we have to do something, and so we're going to fight. And we're going to take for ourselves. And then what they end up doing is exactly what the man who abused their sister did. They take something that they want for themselves. They say, we're going to do what's right by us. We're going to protect our own, and who cares what happens to other people? That they're doing exactly the same thing. That they're right that we can't do nothing. But it's also true that if the way that we deal with difficult circumstances is just to do what the rest of the world does, we're going to bring more trauma into the world. We're going to bring more grief and more sadness, more brokenness. And the God of the Bible is about bringing blessing. His promise is to bring healing and restoration. In that, I said that there are similarities between this and this pattern all the way through Genesis that you see in the garden, that when Adam and Eve see what they want and take it for themselves, they break a relationship with God, and God tells another story. There's another pattern, and the pattern is a God who relentlessly follows his people and wants to bless them. He wants to fix what we have broken, and he's the only one who can fix what we have broken, and he's the one who will fix what we have broken. And this story is about worldviews within God's own people that say, we don't know what to do, so what do we do? And that's why I want to remind us about what Jacob's name means. We've got to wrestle with it. We've got to wrestle with difficult circumstances that we don't see how God is working out in them. That in the midst of loss, in the midst of hurt, in the midst of betrayal, God is working out his purposes. And in the midst of that, when those traumas strike and that pain hits, we can't see it. So often we feel lost and alone. We feel abandoned by God. So do we do nothing? Or do we give in? What Jacob is commended for, and the reason his name is changed, is because he's someone who wrestles with God. He wrestles with it. He says, I don't understand, but I'm going to seek your face. I don't see how this can work out for good, but I trust you are working things out for good. That's what it means to wrestle with God, and that's what I pray we as a church can continue to do in the midst of difficult circumstances so often. The other thing I really want us to do is to point us to the cross at this point. Andy was saying, how are you going to conclude this chapter? When we read this together, how are we going to deal with this as a church? How are we going to respond to this? And the way I want to respond is by looking at the person of Jesus and just pointing out, there's an amazing Bible Project video, which I highly recommend, and I think every time I'm up here, I end up talking about at least one. Jesus is a person who demonstrates what it means to be a person who sees that the world says either we give in or we fight back. And the world says those are the only two things you can do. And Jesus says there is a third way that we can live. To wrestle with God in the midst of difficulty means to follow Jesus' example. The name of the video, just in case you want to watch it, I highly recommend it. It's called The Way of the Exile. And it's talking about in the midst of this, the exact circumstance that Jacob and his family find themselves in, they're in a foreign land, they're trying to settle and set their own home up, but they're surrounded by worldviews that massively differ with them, clash with them, people attack them, people abuse them. This is what happens to his daughter in the midst of this place where God says, I'm going to bring you here and build blessing, and yet this has happened. And so Jesus talks to people who are living under Roman rule. He speaks to God's people and says, in this circumstance, you may think there's only two things you can do. You can either give in or you can fight back. But there is a third way. What we can do is we can respond in a way that disarms and breaks the way that the world says things should work. We can respond with love when all that's thrown at us is hate. When we are abused and when we're taken advantage of, when we deal with difficulty and strife and loss and sorrow, we can respond with blessing. We can give in a way that only we as followers of Jesus can. Because Jesus demonstrated that. On the cross, he prayed for the people who were killing him. He said, God, forgive these people. Isn't that powerful? Forgiveness in the midst of abuse, in the midst of death, in the face of death, Jesus forgave. And that's the example we're called to follow. And it's really hard. That's why we've got to wrestle with it. It is not easy. It's not easy to do, and we've got to pray for each other. We've got to pray with each other. Prayer is the best way that we can respond to this. That is how we wrestle with God. We have to pray. We have to be people who say, I'm not going to give up, but I'm not going to do what the world says either. I'm going to pray and seek God's face and say, how can you bring blessing through me today? How can you use us to bless other people? It's challenging. It's painful. If you feel like you need prayer, we want to pray with you. I'll be up here praying for anyone who wants to pray. I feel like prayer is the only way that we can respond, right? But I want to remind you and encourage you that when we see the face of Jesus, we see a different way to live. A way that says in the midst of trauma, blessing can come. That the God of the Bible never changes, and who he is a God who wants to bless. He wants to restore. He wants to fix what is broken, and he's doing it in us and through us by the power of Jesus. And that's what we're going to bring about. If we seek God's face and we pray and we continue to be people who say, no matter what, I am determined to seek the good of others the way that Jesus seeks the good of me. I'm willing to forgive others the way that Jesus has forgiven me. That can change the world. That can change worldviews. That can break strongholds. And I pray that we can do that together. Amen.